Good morning and welcome. My name is Bonnie Harris, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Susan Mousehart. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Mary Seaver and Mark Ferguson. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR next Sunday at 9 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within the next few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, Susan has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through that door to your left. There you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. As you entered this morning, you were handed a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop the blue card in the bowls alone or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Susan Mousehart. And when Susan realized that she could barely recall the facial features of her three teenagers, except possibly in pictures on Facebook, since they were absorbed in their individual screens and the only view she ever had of them was the back of their heads, she embarked on a journey to reclaim her family, recognizing that she too was caught in an embarrassing relationship with her iPhone, Inez, which claimed 9,637 messages in her inbox. Susan decided to pull the plug. Actually, many plugs all tangled up throughout the house. Her technology shutdown was inspired by one of Susan's favorite books, Walden, in which Henry David Thoreau writes of his journey into the woods. More specifically, her family's experiment was launched by Sherman Paul's words in his introduction to Walden Pond, explaining why Thoreau took to the woods. He wrote, "Thoreau had reduced the means of life, not because he wanted to prove he could go without them, or to disclaim their value in enriching life, but because they were usually factitious. They robbed one of life itself." Susan wanted her children, her very own digital natives, to experience and become familiar with real life, or RL in digital lingo. LOL. When I was asked to moderate for Susan's talk, I got her book with the intention of skimming it. You know, reading the first sentence of every paragraph, skipping chunks of paragraphs, maybe even chapters that seemed irrelevant. But I have to say, the I bet you can't eat just one principle held me captive in non-skimming mode. Her book is hysterical as well as enlightening. I believe we're in for a real treat. So welcome, Susan Mousehart, to the Monadnock region where Henry David himself spent time, climbed our mountain, gained his inspiration, and many believe spoke on that very podium.
Oh my God. Thank God, like, I have been totally cool about this talk until this very moment.
It's not proven.
Oh my God. You know, I went to Walden Pond 2 days ago on my way up, because I went to a wedding in Maine. The planets aligned, and I just happened to, and I've never been to Maine before. I lived in Australia for 26, 27 years, and only returned to my native soil a few years ago. And this is gonna sound ridiculous, but it was my lifelong dream to go to Walden Pond. Such an achievable dream. I'm from Long Island, you know, what's the big deal? But I lived in Western Australia, you know, and I went there 2 days ago, and it was so moving. I mean, everything about it was so moving. Even the chipmunks that I almost stepped on. Because there are a lot of chipmunks up there. And they have a gift shop, which is perhaps unfortunate. On Long Island, where I'm from, we have a place called the Walt Whitman Mall, which I thought was the ultimate in irony until I went to the Walden Pond gift shop. And I almost bought a t-shirt that said, "Beware of all enterprises that require new clothes." A quote, of course, from Walden. Anyway, thank you for that, Bonnie. And guys, you have no idea how happy I am to be here with you this morning. First, because I drove down from Maine early this morning and my GPS stopped speaking to me 2 kilometers out of town, so, and I guess that might have been appropriate. So I'm just glad to be here, but I'm also glad to be here in this pulpit, because a little known fact about myself, I'm a former clergy wife, yes. My first husband was an Anglican minister for my sins. I love saying my first husband like that, you know. makes you kind of, you know, you just want to know how many there were, but that's a professional secret. But as a former clergy wife, I always did have this kind of, I guess you'd call it pulpit envy. You know, like I always secretly longed to be the one who got to climb up the stairs and give the sermon. And, you know, so here I am at last. Aren't you lucky? Yeah, but seriously, in a way, I suppose you could say I've been preaching my whole professional life, only I do it through a different medium, not from a pulpit, but from between the covers of a very secular-seeming book. Now, in my rather extensive experience, because as a clergy wife, you go to church a lot. You know, you go to church the way other people go to the supermarket. You aim for once a week, but that's never enough. But anyway, in my experience, a good preacher needs to be a little bit of a sneaky bastard, as we say in Australia. Thunder and brimstone, they get you nowhere in the age of Instagram. You've got to work more subtly, as Hamlet said, by indirection, find direction out. But enough of my GPS. And now I'm gonna do something that my clergy ex-husband never did. I'm gonna take my heels off, okay? Because that'll bring me a little bit closer to my text, and then I won't have to strain so much. Okay, now your neighbor Emily Dickinson, whose home I'm going to visit on my way back to Long Island, she confessed that she saw New Englandly, which is the best adverb ever. And I think she meant pretty much the same thing as Hamlet did when she wrote, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies." Good preaching is kind of roundabout, just like good poetry, or for that matter, good parenting. It sort of meanders a little bit to lull you into a false sense of security, tells a few stories, tells a few jokes, passes the time of day, then bam, it pounces. So good preachers, again, like good parents, need to be as wily as serpents and as gentle as doves, in the words of that immortal marketing manager, St. Matthew. My text for the thinly disguised sermon that was my book, or that is my book, The Winter of Our Disconnect, is taken from the Gospel of Henry David Thoreau, another visionary neighbor of yours who saw New Englandly. I wanted to write a book about the impact of technology on everyday life and especially on family life, but more than that, I wanted to learn how to live deliberately with technology and not as a default mode. That word deliberately is one of Thoreau's favorites. It appears as if men had deliberately chosen the common mode of living because they preferred it to any other, he wrote in Walden,
yet they honestly think there is no choice left. When I decided to reject the common mode of living by taking myself and my three teenagers offline entirely for 6 months, I can't tell you how many people told me I couldn't do that. Not only that I shouldn't, there were plenty of people who told me that too, but that I couldn't. They honestly thought there was no choice left. My kids certainly thought so. Life without the internet, instant messaging, smartphones, social media, email, gaming, television, or videos seemed quite simply not life at all. My son and daughters, then aged between 14 and 18, are what we have now learned to call digital natives. I, like most of you, if not all of you, okay, not you, I am a digital immigrant, and I speak with a thick foreign accent. I still talk about dialing people's numbers, and I can never remember whether to post or what's a profile and what's a page. I can't quite get myself to use friend as a transitive verb. When it comes to uploads and downloads, I can never remember which way is up or down. I don't know. I was, having said that, seriously acculturated to new media in my own way. But unlike my kids, I retained indelible memories of the old country, that time my children referred to as the black and white days, with no irony whatsoever. Even many of my own friends seemed confused by the historical boundaries. "Oh, I get it," they would remark in derision or awe. "You're going back to the 19th century." "Not really," I explained, "more like 1985. Now, Thoreau, as you know, was not a fan of any high-tech much glitzier than an axe or a hoe. And it's no coincidence that he was a pencil maker by trade. As for the new media of his day, the telegraph, the railroad, the penny press, he was cynical to the point of paranoia, which is awesome. This was a man who worried about the corrupting influence of the post office. And he said, again in Walden, "For my part, I could easily do without the post office. I think that there are very few important communications made through it. To speak critically, I never received more than one or two letters in my life that were worth the postage." What the hell would he make of your inbox? Or mine? Now, I've moved on since that figure, that excruciatingly correct figure that Bonnie quoted before. In my inbox last year, I managed to accumulate 17,452 unread emails, and my red letter day of the entire year was the day I removed them with one keystroke, and I spent all morning Googling how to do that. Okay, Thoreau on the news, because that was another thing, you know, one worries about unplugging. You won't know what's going on. But the news? What about the news? He wrote, "I am sure that I never read any memorable news in a newspaper." Forget about a blog. "If we read of one man robbed or murdered or killed by accident or one house burned or one vessel wrecked or one steamboat blown up, we never need read of another. One is enough." You know, I feel exactly the same way about Facebook posts. When told of the telegraph that had recently connected Maine to Texas amidst a frenzy of national suspender snapping, Thoreau remarked, "What if Maine has nothing to say to Texas?" Yes, a media critic par excellence. Back in 1845, Thoreau worried that people were becoming the tools of their tools. As a mother, I found myself worrying about the same thing pretty much every day of my life. Most of the other parents I knew did too at some level. The battle to get them off had gradually become a major site for struggle, whether it was the first-person shooter game, the Facebook page, or the smartphone connected like an IV drip to the ears. Like so many others, I felt almost as if I'd been ambushed by all this. Rightly or wrongly, and probably wrongly given that I'd supplied 9/10 of the hardware myself, I felt I had never actually chosen to live my life this way or to raise my children this way. But somehow or other, one day I woke up to find that it had happened almost in spite of me. So what exactly is the way of life I refer to? How were we living before the experiment? The short answer is screened. Screened from one another, screened from our five senses and our own deepest selves, screened from what my son unironically called RL, real life. Bill at this point was gaming up to 6 hours a day, and most of my conversations with him, and I do use that word loosely, began with my saying, "Honey, could you just press pause for a second and whatever else it was?" My girls rarely broke suction on their social media unless it was to download music, watch YouTubes, or stalk celebrities through the many mansions of their social media. To be honest, I wasn't that far behind them. My relationship with my iPhone, yes, Lily Inez, oh God, had all the intensity of an illicit affair. This is so humiliating. Now remember, we're talking 2008 when the world was young. I can only plead that I was immature. I gave it a pet name. I started buying it outfits. You know, the subtitle of my book, it's like one of the longest subtitles in history, how three totally wired teenagers and a mother who slept with her iPhone pulled the plug on their technology, blah, 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 blah. Well, at the time, to admit openly that you slept with your iPhone, well, that took courage. I mean, you were really outing yourself in those days. Today, everybody sleeps with their iPhone. You know, you should have a subtitle that says, "And I don't sleep with my iPhone." And be, "Oh, well, I'm gonna buy that. She doesn't sleep with her iPhone. Holy cow." There's no more shame attached to that now than there is to online dating or, you know, I don't know, Googling yourself, which still sounds shameful to me. Especially when you say it from a pulpit. Anyway, but back to our story. So there I was, sneaking my iPhone under the covers and into the bathroom, and all the while thundering at my kids to log off their digital drugs of choice for 5 minutes. And I was not completely unaware that there was, dare I say it, a disconnect there somewhere. And then I reread Walden, which is my favorite book in the universe, and which I do reread, you know, more or less every year. But that experience at that particular moment in time, oh, and I was menopausal, lol. Blame the hormones a little bit there. All those three things combined pushed me over the edge. You know how they say you're not ready to go to rehab till you hit rock bottom? Well, we'd hit it. It was a case of desperate times calling for desperate measures. And yes, of course, I've tried, and people have asked me, you know, haven't you ever tried to just set some sensible limits? Yes, I had tried to set sensible limits, as they say in the parenting magazines. I tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed. At predictable intervals, I'd blow a fuse and either yank the modem out of the wall or I'd lay down the law. 2 hours of internet a day, I tried that once. Well, three kids, a single mother, I'm working full time, you do the math. The surveillance alone was a killer. Then we tried no internet past 9 p.m. And then it was like, "But Mom, you know, I've got homework." You know, that was the magic word, homework, to make the modem snap back on again. But once or twice when we would have dinner parties with other families, I'd collected all the kids' cell phones as they came through the door in a big basket. And, you know, their parents were right there and saying, "Yes, well, you know, she's the hostess, so, you know." Collect them in a big basket, and I'd switch off the modem, and I noticed this amazing transformation happening. Because, you know, when I hadn't done that, there'd be a few awkward exchanges, and then everybody would retreat to their own separate little, you know, informational bubbles. And it was almost as if they were being tugged back, you know, to the magnetic north of their technology. But when they were forcefully untethered, they reverted almost instantly to RL, to real life again, like real people, like real kids, chattering, laughing, playing games, being annoying, just, you know, connected. They were connected. One night, a big group of 16-year-olds played hide and seek. A 6'2" boy folded himself up like an origami crane to fit on a high shelf. You know, it was hilarious. It was also almost shocking to see that transformation happen in a group of kids once they were stripped of their technological armor. the discomfort, the eye contact avoidance, that eerie silence that descends on a group of texting teens. All that was gone, as if with the push of a button, or the failure to push a button, as the case may be. Why can't it be like this all the time? I sighed. But the real light bulb moment for me was a day when I came home from work to be greeted, as was woefully typical at the time, by the sight of the back of three heads, each bent over its respective array of open tabs, perhaps one of homework to a dozen distractions, games, shopping, YouTube, social media, messaging, multitasking, they called it. Yeah, as if they were juggling chores instead of kitten videos. So on this particular fateful day, I call out a greeting. No one answers. Short of a radical earbudectomy, how could they even hear me? Now, exactly what happened next, the screen kind of goes blurry for me here, but I'm pretty sure I snapped, and I'm pretty sure that made them uncork their earbuds. I definitely remember gesturing towards the laptops and the PC and the phones and the TV and bleating helplessly, more to myself, frankly, than to anyone else. What on earth would our lives be like without all this crap? The kids exchanged glances, turned back to their tasks with an audible sigh. Then my son spoke up. What would our lives be like? They'd be boring, that's what. They're boring now, I wanted to thunder, but I swallowed that. Bill thinks of himself as being a supremely rational person. I should make my point in a rational manner. Think about it, Bill, I began in a calmer tone of voice. Are you saying that for the entirety of human history, up to the invention of the integrated circuit, people were just bored all the time? He shrugged and went back to swinging his virtual mace. But I could tell he was thinking about it. You can tell from the back of someone's head that they're thinking about it, you know? Just like you can tell if somebody is texting when you're talking to them, right? Even if you're on the phone and you can't see them, they get that quality of their voice. It kind of like the blinds go down. Anyway, he turned around and he said, obviously they were bored, Mom. That's why they invented the computer. Okay, it was a direct hit, but I was quick to recover. So, without boredom, there would be no computer. Is that what you're saying? Right. And with that, he headed back to the Valley of the Twisted Gnomes, or wherever the hell he was living, a quarter of his waking hours at that point. So boredom is really kind of important, isn't it? I mean, if you're never bored, you'll never have to relieve your boredom, and if you never have to relieve your boredom, you probably won't bother creating or innovating or leaving your comfort zone at all. By this time, of course, I was talking to myself. Mother of three teenagers, you know, you get that constantly. But the earbuds had been reinserted and Bill was once more lost in his game. I didn't care. I literally ran to my own computer and started Googling the history of boredom. It was fascinating. My book has a chapter all about, you know, boredom and how amazing it is. It's important. I started following the trail of ideas, and I started hatching one of my own. Okay, there's a joke that I think pretty much explains the dynamic of what happened next in our family. It's a joke about a nice Jewish boy who, aged, you know, 45, lives at home, and he's never spoken a word to his doting parents. One day they're having dinner, and out of the blue, he says, could you please pass the salt? And the parents are astounded. They, you know, they cry out, son, you can speak. Why have you never said anything before? The son shrugs. Up till now, everything's been fine. I reckon that's the key joke of our experiment. Now, the key fable is one that I didn't learn until after it was all over. It's an old Chinese fable, and it's told by the author Li Kengxing in his book, Mao's Last Answer. Here's the fable. There was a frog that lived in a small, deep well. He knew nothing but the world he lived in. His well in the sky, he could see above it, were his entire universe. One day, he met a frog who lived in the world above. Why don't you come down and play with me? It's fun down here, the frog in the well asked. What's down there? The frog above asked. Oh, we have everything down here. You name it. The streams, the undercurrent, the stars, the occasional moon. We even get flying objects coming down from the sky sometimes, the frog in the well answered. The frog on the land sighed. My friend, you live in a confined world. You haven't seen what's out here in the bigger world. The frog below was very annoyed. Don't you tell me you have a bigger world than ours. My world is big. We see and experience everything the world has to offer, the well frog said. No, my friend. You can only see the world above you through the size of the well. Publishers today speak of a genre they call shtick lit. Have you ever heard of that? You've heard of chick lit, right? Okay, well, shtick lit is basically, it's from the Yiddish word shtick, which means like a routine. It's where the author lives out a shtick, like cooking all of Julia Child's recipes in a year. Does that ring a bell? Or having sex with your husband every day for a year. I'm not making that up. There are two books that were published within 6 months of each other that in which that was the shtick. A.J. Jacobs is a great purveyor of this genre. He wrote a wonderful book called My Life is an Experiment. These books have enjoyed a huge vogue in our time, the idea of treating life as an experiment. I guess Eat, Pray, Love was the one that really tipped the literary world over into this. But the idea of treating your own life as an experiment doesn't come from Liz Gilbert and it doesn't come from A.J. Jacobs. It comes from Thoreau. Here is life, he proclaimed in Walden, an experiment to a great extent untried. And elsewhere, and even more fittingly, Thoreau remarked, how could youths better learn to live than by at once trying the experiment of living? Okay, little side journey here. I have to tell you, I put my hands on those quotes instantly by doing a keyword search on the Project Gutenberg edition of Walden. It's online. You know Project Gutenberg? If you don't, you should. You never have to buy another classic book in your life if you don't want to. They're all there for you for free. Walden is certainly one of them, and they're searchable. It's amazing. Thousands and thousands of classic texts that are out of copyright. I also consulted, and this is really true confessions, my edition of Walden on my Kindle. I'm sorry. But I will tell you, it was the very first book I ever downloaded when I got a Kindle, and that's either incredibly appropriate or just plain perverse. But I tell you this to underscore an important point, which is that I am no Luddite. How could I be with such feasts as the Project Gutenberg laid upon my table? Having said all that, you won't be surprised to hear that my most treasured copy of Walden is the one on my shelf. Actually, it's in my car at the moment. I brought it with me for sentimental reasons. It's the Riverside edition I've had since the age of 20 that is now a perfect palimpsest of annotations and inks of every color and vintage. I've not just read this book, I've had conversations with it that have lasted my whole lifetime and will continue to do so. And those underlinings and annotations, they're the evidence of my relationship. I never take my copy of Walden off the shelf without inhaling its comforting mustiness, its notes of sweetness and slight decay. After all these years, the paper cover is as supple as leather, very old leather that has lived a long and useful life. You don't get that in a Kindle edition, my friends. Equally, you can't do a keyword search on a paperback, so I say it's best to stay as inclusive as you can. It's so easy to throw the digital native out with the bathwater. I think of Socrates. You should think of Socrates too. You know, we should all think of Socrates, who fervently believed that reading and writing, which happened to be the new medium of his day, you know, literacy, would destroy the fabric of society. He was so opposed to it, for real, he never wrote anything down. And it's only thanks to his student, Plato, who, you know, kind of was a new media guy, he embraced the new technology, and that's how we know what Socrates thought about reading and writing. And by the way, BT dubs, as my daughter would say. Everything Socrates said about writing is true. All the terrible things he said were true. He said three things in particular: that reading and writing would erode memory, because the Greeks had amazing mnemonic powers. It would endanger privacy, because you would write something down and you'd lose control over it. You wouldn't know where it might end up. And that it would force people, or at least encourage them, to become passive learners, following rather than engaging in arguments. All true. The point is, those weren't the only truths about reading and writing. There are many more than those to be reckoned. So, I guess that's a plea for humility on all of this. Like, nobody can know for sure. Nobody can know for sure. Not even Socrates. So for the first 2 weeks of our experiment, we had no electricity at all. I decided to go cold turkey, you know, boot camp. I told the kids that actually I, you know, organized for the power company to stop all power to our home. In fact, I flipped the switch myself, and it gave me chills to do so. It was the 4th of January, 2009. Because we lived in the Southern Hemisphere in Australia, I did the reverse of Thoreau's timing. So he started on the 4th of July, Independence Day, his experiment, and I timed ours so that we would finish on the 4th of July, Independence Day. Anyway, the point is we had no electricity, we had no fridge, no microwave, washing machine, et cetera, and most horrifying of all for my two daughters, no hair straighteners. What? The kids were in a state of shock initially, but the surprising truth is that in summer, at least, a totally dark house can be a totally cool house. I equipped everyone with a personal lantern. Yes, there were lots of Hogwarts jokes. People ran around playing spotlight and hide and seek, and instead of changing outfits two or three times a day, we all became slightly grubbier. I loved it because I couldn't do anything. You know, like I couldn't cook a meal, and I couldn't do laundry, and I couldn't vacuum. Unbelievably great. I commend it to you. I put everybody in charge of doing their own hand washing, and you could see them sort of silently counting up the number of underpants they had. There was some other strange behavior in the first few weeks, reading books by candlelight, playing shadow puppets, literally shadow puppets, on the bedroom wall. Oddest of all, the kids' friends were besieging them with requests for sleepovers. They wanted to come to our house. You know, so much for all those warnings that I'd be destroying my kids' social lives. Wall. And I got a lot of that, actually. But this was summertime. The living was easy. I was anxious about what would happen once school started, and I needed to get back to work. There was one escape clause written into our contract, but it was a big one. The media ban was only in effect in our house, also in our car. Now, the kids were able to access the internet at school or at other people's houses, and they realized early on that they could catch just a wisp of signal if they sat outside on the curb. And they argued forcefully that this being not home ought to be allowed. They were overruled. by the way, you must be thinking by now, like, how did I ever get my kids to agree to this? Are you thinking that? Or you just think they're just so obedient? You know, like, yes, Marmy, yes, Marmy. I bribed them with money. It's the best kind of bribe, yeah. More on that later, perhaps, in question time. Well, I thought it would keep them honest, you know, because they said, well, you know, why? I said, well, you know, it's a whole new world out there. You're going to have this amazing experience, and, you know, you'll never be the same again after the 6 months. Plus, I might write a book about it. And they were like, with royalties? You're going to make money off of our misery? So I was like, well, yes, but, you know, hopefully, but nobody is going to want to buy the book unless you're absolutely 100% committed and do what you say you're going to do. So what do you reckon? So it ended up being, you know, a pretty smart thing. Wasn't sure that I was going to bribe them at the outset, but I was kind of glad they twisted my arm. And every once in a while, I'd hear somebody say in the back seat, do you want your money or don't you? Okay. Yeah, so the homework thing. This was the trump card the kids tried to play right from the start. How could they possibly complete their assignments without the internet, they pleaded, their faces perfectly composed masks of misery. At first, the question, I have to say, did scare me. It was true that much of their homework was posted online, and a fair amount required online resources to complete. I mean, a school report without Wikipedia? It's like prom night without a stretch limo. I mean, really, talk about cruelty to children. Do it at school, I suggested. You know, there's this secret place they have where it's super quiet because no one ever goes there. It's called the library. They were like, no! They held up their hands like they were, you know, fending off a rabid bat or something. But eventually they went. The girls went quite often, actually. And they discovered that putting some boundaries of time and space around their work was an enchanted fix for actually getting it done. Allowing work to bleed into life and life into work is perhaps the most obvious and most pernicious effect to date of life in the age of email. That lack of separation not only affects you and me, it affects our kids too. It adds to their anxiety, their struggle to manage time and sleep, and their sense of satisfaction on any given day. Clear beginnings and clear endings, punctuation marks with crisp, clean outlines, these are essential to our happiness, or that's my theory anyway. To come home knowing your homework is behind you rather than looming up before you like some angry spirit, I mean, that's addictive. You know, Candy Crush is nothing to that. You can really get hooked on this. One person got my reference. Thank you, dear. Okay, eating was another area of life in which we'd gotten all kind of fuzzy around the edges. You know, there were no clear-cut boundaries anymore. In fact, I realized, my daughter said to me, you know, my eldest said to me when she was 13 or something, you know, said, it's dinner ready, are you hungry? And she said, no. You know, I'm never hungry. Really? Yeah, I've never really been hungry my whole life. Oh, I forgot to stop demand feeding 13 years ago. You know, I had teenagers and they were still, you know, demand feeding. They were still just picking at bits and pieces along the way whenever they got hungry. So once upon a time, though, we had been a family that sat down to meals together before all the technology got in the way. And the kitchen in those days had been the functional beating heart of our home. In recent years, we'd undergone a bypass big time. People had started to grab a bite wherever they could, at their quote-unquote workstations, where they were doing tasks, or on the way to school, or sports practice, or social events. My friend Susan in Australia, who grew up on an outback sheep station, used to wonder why people didn't just eat pellets like livestock. Watching my kids graze, I often wondered the same thing myself. You know, we didn't dine anymore, heaven knows, we just fueled. I see now that I was a big part of the problem. Sure, their lives had got busier, and mine had too. Sitting down to meals, I had convinced myself, was a luxury that working families like ours couldn't afford. And everybody knew that. There simply wasn't time to squander on sit-down home-cooked meals like some sepia-toned tableau from the golden age of grade B television. I wasn't entirely pleased to see the collection of cereal bowls and teacups littering the backseat of our car most mornings, or to hear the crash of crockery and the clatter of coffee spoons each time we went over a speed bump, but I accepted it as part of the deal of modern family life. You know, this business about not having time? We, each of us, were handed 6 hours a day when we pulled the plug. I mean, it's almost a full-time job. This myth of no time in the age of information is something we seriously need to be examining. Anyway, at dinner time, however, I would try very hard to bring all the stakeholders to the table. Sometimes, against the odds, I even succeeded. But between my son's sports schedule and my daughter's social schedules and everyone's repeated pleadings for chill-out time, a thinly veiled euphemism for sitting trance-like before their respective screens, achieving a quorum at the dinner table had become a rarity. And even when I succeeded in corralling them to the table, my best diplomacy failed to keep them there. Most nights, Bill would be washing down the last bite of his dinner with the third glass of milk by the time I picked up my fork. "Thanks, Mom," he called cheerfully as he dumped his plate in the sink and turned fervently once more towards the Mecca of MSN. He'd sit back down if I insisted, of course, but forcing a boy to be sociable is a bit like teaching a pug to break dance. The quality of the result just isn't worth the bother. "So how is school?" I'd ask. "Yeah, good," he'd say. "What are you reading in English at the moment?" "Books." "Can I go now?" The girls didn't eat quite as fast, but the pattern was much the same. By the way, this has been studied. It's called speed eating. Speed eating, yes, and it afflicts families. It was amazing what I learned when I did the research for this book. Things that I thought it was just us, that I was too ashamed to say out loud. There were whole sociological tracts devoted to the data on this. So I felt, you know, the girls were the same. They'd sort of bolt their food and race back to their social media. It was almost as if we'd become corporately one of those joyless married couples you see at restaurants eating purposefully and in total silence, together in flesh, but on entirely separate hemispheres of the spirit. Even before the experiment, I had banned texting at the table. Indeed, I'd never allowed it. But most nights, I could feel their attention being tugged by their absent media, like a spider sensing a fly at the far edge of its web. They were all three so clearly just tolerating our time together. It was as if the kitchen had become a transit lounge, an uncongenial place of temporary detention, a pit stop separating them from the virtual places they would much rather be. Now, when I was growing up, you know, everybody ate dinner together around a table, you know, with utensils every night, right? Eating in front of the television was not entirely unheard of, especially on Sunday night when Ed Sullivan was on. If that doesn't date me, I don't know what does, but anyway, eating in front of the TV, even for Ed Sullivan, was a vice my mother disapproved of. "Too much upsetment," she decreed, as if eating our tuna patties off a TV tray would cause us to run amok, ripping the plastic covers from the formal lounge with bared canines. Was I nostalgic for all this rigidity? I was not. As a parent, I'd frankly never wanted to bring back the halcyon days of casseroles held together with mushroom soup mucilage and family mealtimes so rigid and ritualized you could practically hear your arteries harden. At the same time, I was determined to use the experiment as an opportunity to bring more structure to mealtimes, to put more energy into appreciating what we had on our plates or noticing it even. In one survey, 4 in 10 mothers described dinner as an unpleasant experience. At the same time, 76% agree that sit-down meals strengthen a family's communication, and possibly its vocal cords, who knows. Is there a contradiction here? Not necessarily. You know, as well as I do, that the research correlating just having that family meal in the evening and outcomes, positive outcomes for kids, is incredible. I mean, it's almost magical how just doing that one simple ritual once a day, and you don't have to even cook the food, that's the good news. You don't have to cook the food. You can get Subway. You can eat it out of the wrapper. As long as you sit in a space together as a family and eat that food without technology, amazing things can happen, from, you know, kids getting better grades, you know, being more resilient and having more grit and, you know, taking fewer drugs and no alcohol and, you know, not having unsafe sex. It's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, it just really defies belief. Okay, I think I've made my point because, you know, the relationship, of course, between family media use and the likelihood that you're going to sit down and have that meal, totally inverse. A couple of other big effects from our digital detox. Sleep, okay? Now, the journals are replete with research on the connection between our media use and the quality and quantity of sleep we get at night. At the time that we did our experiment, it wasn't so much the case. I had to scrabble around. All I had was my own laboratory, if you will, my own laboratory rats, my beautiful children. And what I realized was that my youngest, in particular, had probably been suffering with a huge sleep debt for years. The way she responded initially to the experiment, well, her first reaction was to say, you know what, I might move in with Dad just for a few months, because I really miss him. You know, it's been, okay. Anyway, she came back after a couple of weeks, and then she coped for, I would say, almost the first 6 weeks by sleeping almost around the clock. When she wasn't in school, she would come home, uniform, big clunky shoes on. She would walk in the door, say, so boring in here, so boring at home. And she'd go in her room and fall like a tree, like face down on her bed, shoes and all, and sleep until dinner. She'd wake up, she'd eat, go back to sleep. I would have suspected, frankly, clinical depression if she hadn't been so chirpy, you know, those few times when she was actually awake. At about 6 weeks, it was like, I'm telling you, it was like something out of Disney. She awoke as if from a, you know, a slumber. It was on a Saturday morning. She woke up at like 8:30 and came into my room. She's like, Random, why did I wake up? What's wrong with me? Like, it was Saturday. You're supposed to sleep until, you know, 4 at least on Saturday. She had finally repaid her sleep debt. And the result of it for that child in particular, she was 14 at the time, was something like a personality transplant. You know, all of her behavior, all of her bullshiness and her mood swings that, frankly, we put down to being 14 and a girl, seemed to explain a lot, was largely the result of a child who had been systematically deprived of sleep for probably 2 or 3 years, ever since she discovered Skype. She used to Skype her school friends after school. My first experience of Skype was coming in her bedroom, tell her to, you know, put the laptop away now. I assumed she was watching a video. It was a young girl who looked very animated on the screen, and then the young girl said, hi, Susan. I almost died. But, you know, that's what they do. My son, the gamer, instead of devoting 6 hours a day to World of Warcraft, literally found his saxophone buried in his closet. He spent a couple of days playing Lego. That was the first layer. He was 16. Okay, because that's how bored he was. Then he found his saxophone. He started playing his saxophone an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. By midway through the experiment, he was playing his saxophone maybe 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day. The best and worst moment for me, I have to say, of the entire 6 months came on the day that he said, if only I could have all those hours back that I spent on that stupid game to practice my saxophone, how awesome would I be right now? And I didn't know whether to, you know, leap for joy or to, like, you know, stab myself with guilt that I hadn't intervened earlier. So just, can I just spend a minute bringing you up to date on what we're doing now? And just to say, of course, that the biggest impact for us of the experiment was the impact on our relationships as a family. You know, we made eye contact. It wasn't an event. It was every day. We talked to each other. We hung out. I mean, we weren't always holding Socratic dialogues, trust me. We weren't always reading Proust. We never read Proust, actually. But, you know, we hung out. We stayed in the same room together, which is something that hadn't happened for many years. Anyway. At the end of the experiment, and this isn't in the book, my son actually sold his beloved gaming computer, which had been packed up and sent to a friend for the 6 months. He sold it to buy a saxophone, a better saxophone. He went on after school to a prestigious music school to study jazz. He still plays professionally now and then, but regards it as more of a hobby and is now completing a degree in marine science. He works on a pearl farm on the Abrolhos Islands in the remote northwest coast of Western Australia, where it is impossible to pick up a signal most days. But he studies remotely, So he downloads his lectures onto a thumb drive, goes a day up the coast of Western Australia, 4 hours out towards Africa to a little coral reef with his thumb drive, watches his lectures on that. But he can't text and he can't use the phone. He's developed a taste for going off the grid. Ani, my eldest daughter, is a feature writer for an Australian magazine called Scoop and practices Facebook fasting as a regular discipline. She still struggles with keeping her bedroom tech-free, and I suppose I don't help much, what with our habit of binge texting each other first thing in the morning and last thing at night, because we are now a bi-hemispheric family, and if it were not for technology, I would be dead of a broken heart. That's the irony. Skype, Facebook, you know, texting, unlimited everything is what connects me to my family now in the times that I'm not with them. When my daughter's in Australia and I'm in New York, we watch this horrible reality show that I love called Long Island Medium. Have you seen it? I commend it to you. We watch it on my Amazon Instant Video account together separately. Sassy, my youngest, the one who had the sleep debt, will graduate this year with a degree in what else? Media. A year after our experiment ended, we moved to the U.S. We moved back from Australia to the U.S. after she had spent her whole life in Australia. I was mightily impressed when she used her social media skills to create an entire network of friends in her new high school on Long Island from Western Australia. The day I went to enroll her, a group of kids appeared out of nowhere, screamed her name, "Sussy!" and they ran and embraced each other. So who knew? A connection. She's in college now. She wrote her personal essay on the topic, Why I'm Special. And the answer was, because I survived without the internet for 6 months. As for me, I'm still devoted to my iPhone, but, you know, put it this way, we're no longer sleeping together. Thank you.